hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court will say that the government of the United States is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is John Unruh and others, plaintiffs versus Davidson County, Hutchinson County, and others, defendants. For the defendants, we have Mr. Gary Kimson, James Power, and Sherry Raymond, from attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Kimson, I understand you'll be presenting the argument.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And for the state, I believe it would be Sheila Woodward, an attorney from Yankton. Mr. Kimson, I assume you are the appellant, since you're sitting on that side of the room. Very good. You may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
And please, the court, there's one word.
Chief Justice correctly acknowledges that I, myself, Ms. Raymond, and Mr. Power represent collectively the defendants in this case. I'll call them the Davidson County defendants. The amicus brief is not entitled to an opportunity to argue with Mr. Dibert, who represents the Hutchinson County defendants, as I'll call them, has generously ceded his time to me to argue on behalf of all defendants. There's one question, or one question only before the court today, and that is the waiver of statutory immunity as certified by Judge Pearsall from the United States District Court in Sioux Falls. Now, briefly, the facts underlying this case have to do with a Hutchinson County inmate arrested in Hutchinson County and charged in Hutchinson County, but housed by a contract arrangement in the Davidson County Jail, transported to Davidson County by a Hutchinson County deputy, then admitted and processed, and thereafter in the hands of the Davidson County Jail staff. During the course of Mr. Unruh's incarceration, I should interject that he was admitted, I think all would agree, in a highly intoxicated state. During the course of his incarceration there, he began exhibiting physical symptoms that apparently grew progressively worse to the point where finally outside medical help was sought. He was transported from there to a Vera Quita Peace and ultimately to the Vera Heart Hospital in Sioux Falls and was pronounced dead there. His heirs had brought a wrongful death and Section 1983 suit against Davidson County, its staff, and Hutchinson County and its staff, alleging not only the constitutional deprivation in Section 1983, which is not at issue here today, but also various state tort claims against the counties and their respective employees, sounding primarily in negligence. The defendants, pursuant to SDCL 3-21, 8, and 9, alleged affirmatively that they were immune from suit. The state tort claims pursuant to the statutory immunity conferred by those statutes. The plaintiffs, the estate, requested that Judge Pearsall certify the question to the court as to whether or not, I'm going to use generically the word insurance, but whether or not a county or its employees either purchasing insurance coverage or participating in a risk pool, the difference here, the difference between the two is not significant to our question, waives or abrogates the statutory immunity of 321, 8, and 9 to the extent of coverage provided. We, of course, contend that it does not, that to hold otherwise would be contrary to the express intent of the legislature, and that the immunities should stand in litigation. Of course, the estate's position on that issue is the opposite, saying that clearly because the legislature abrogated sovereign immunity, to the extent the state has coverage largely by the People Fund, that abrogation should therefore carry over to statutory immunity to the extent there's coverage available. And I think that's contrary to what I would determined to be the clear intent of the legislature and also contrary to prior decisions of this court.
What's the time frame on those? Was one passed before the other?
Yeah, they were both passed in March of 1986, Justice Meyer Henry. The jail immunity statute on March 19 and the immunity waiver on March 28 of 86, according to my notes, both found in the 1986 session laws. And I think that's a central question, and I appreciate Justice Meyer Henry having asked that, because here we have the legislature who looks at the ancient doctrine of sovereign immunity, which we know comes from Runnymede and the Magna Carta and so forth, and the king can do no wrong. Even early on, the sovereign or his regents recognized the injustice of that and said, wait a minute, I can't sue the king, but certain of his officials and so forth ought to be amenable to suit where the king consents to it, where they have done wrongful things to the subjects. And fast forward to the South Dakota Constitution, which recognized, embodied, if you will, the sovereign immunity doctrine within its terms, and the legislature, I think, making a public policy decision, said, look, you know, it's really not fair that if somebody's driving to work and they get hit by a state employee going, let's say, on a building inspection, that they should be without any remedy simply because that person was driving a state car. These are things that are not high functions or policy level activities of state government, and so we're going to form this fund because our citizens, if they're wrongfully injured by state employees doing or going about the kinds of things that all other citizens do, they ought to be equally liable.
So when it says,
so that's what happened.
When it says in 2132A1 that the public entity shall be deemed to have waived the common law doctrine of sovereign immunity and shall be deemed to have consented to suit, are the terms waive and consent, is that a redundancy, or do they have an individual meaning, a separate meaning?
Well, no, I don't think they're a redundancy, Justice Kohlenkamp. I think they do have a separate meaning. You can waive it, say, okay, we not only waive the immunity, but we consent to suit in these circumstances. I think the critical word, though, in the statute, sir, that you've cited is neither waive nor consent, but sovereign. Sovereign immunity, and this court has recognized, as did the Eighth Circuit in the Webb case, has repeatedly recognized that sovereign and statutory immunities are separate creatures. The legislature setting upstairs here back in 1986, that's 21 years ago now, certainly knew that difference. And it to me is inconceivable that they would say, okay, here we're going to have sovereign immunity and we're going to allow ourselves to be sued. In these certain circumstances, we're not going to claim the prerogative of the crown, if you will. However, we realize that there are certain activities that are so highly discretionary and highly fraught with the possibility for litigation on the one hand, and that as public policy deems necessary that by statute we protect these actors from suit. And so at the very same time, they're saying, okay, here's what we've got, the statutory, the sovereign immunity, and we're going to waive that. For the things that we go about, we mean collectively the state of South Dakota and its employees, doing what ordinary citizens might do, we ought to have liability if co-citizens are injured. So we're going to have a people fund, we're going to waive that. But at the same time, we realize that there are certain activities, like running a jail, that are so important and so critical that we cannot hamper its activity by having these people subjected to suit after suit after suit. And therefore, we're going to have the statutory immunity for that. And they didn't say all immunity in 2132A, but just sovereign immunity. And again, this court and others have long recognized that distinction. And that's what we're here arguing today, that where there is a statutory immunity, that is a specific grant by the legislature. Many of them are like reporting child abuse. A person makes a good faith report to the authorities that they believe a child is being abused. They are immune from suit. Now, arguably, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, that they might have some homeowners or other personal coverage for that. Does that mean that if in good faith a lady believes that there's abuse going on next door and she's sufficiently concerned about the welfare of young children, she makes a good faith, objectively reasonable complaint to the authorities about child abuse, which for one reason or another turns out not to be found or it gets dismissed, that she's not that she is now going to be amenable to suit for having made that report.
Do you think it's logical for the legislature to conclude that if the deputy runs into the decedent on the way to work and kills him in a car accident, the deputy can be sued, but if the deputy allows him to die in a jail, he can't be?
Yeah, I think it's eminently logical, Chief Justice, and for this reason. You and I could drive an automobile, we could go to the wrong side of the road, we could run a stop sign, we could speed, we could make a left turn in front of an oncoming vehicle, just as the deputy driving his or her patrol car can do. But you and I, maybe you can, but I cannot go into a jail and run up and say, this is what this person's going to eat, this is when he showers, this is when she gets her cell inspection, this is when we're going to let her out for exercise. So those are functions far different. And I think that's exactly the distinction that the legislature was aiming at. The driving of the automobile is something, that any of our citizens can do. The running of a jail is a highly complex and focused activity that only a few are entrusted with. And so I think that that's exactly what the legislature was saying. Sovereign immunity, we're not going to have it. But not only running a jail, having recreational land use, using an automatic electric defibrillator, that was rendered immune from liability by the 2000 legislature. And a different, I think that's another good example. We have them at our office, and they may have had me in mind, and we've trained personnel to use these. Now, somebody in our office, in the Hughes County Courthouse or any other place, collapses, and there's somebody there trained to use these defibrillators, and they're saying, I could save that person's life, but, boy, if I burn him or something, I'm going to be sued, and I'm not going to do it. And the legislature says, hey, if saving that life is too important, and we're going to say that you are immune. Now, certainly, again, they created a statutory immunity. And it's clearly not intended for the sovereign, because I think more likely than not, persons using defibrillators are likely to be private rather than governmental employees acting in the course and scope of their employment. Excuse me.
Just take your water up there with you if you'd like.
So we have a list, and the other side of the brief, of immunities carved out by statute by the legislature after the adoption of the People Fund and the sovereign immunity statute. So I think they are clearly distinct. And the public policy of the state of South Dakota is determined that these certain activities, as identified by the legislature and enacted by the legislature and signed by the governor, are of significant public interest, that the prosecution or execution, if you will, of those functions has to be immune from liability for them to function efficiently and properly. And that's what the legislature's done here, as opposed to saying, but we're not going to do it simply because we have the ermine robe, because we are the king. We are not going to immunize ourselves, again, collectively meaning the state and its employees, for tort liability for those people who are conducting everyday activities that any other citizen might conduct, the deputy sheriff driving the vehicle being the example. But for you are dealing with child abuse, physician peer review, public land use, administering a jail, these are activities that the private citizens generally do not engage in, and that they are so important to the functioning of society and to public policy that we are going to immunize those actors from state liability. I think it's critical to recognize, as this court did in Hancock, and as the Eighth Circuit did in Webb, that this does not deprive the injured or constitutionally affronted plaintiffs a forum or vehicle for recovery. As Webb said, Section 1983 does that. So a wronged inmate is not without recourse, is not without an avenue toward damage recovery, injunctive relief, and so forth. Well, I think the court's made clear that that immunity statutes don't impair a court's ability to grant injunctive relief. So the estate has its remedy. And its remedy can go full force in state or federal court, in this case in federal court. But the federal court has to respect the immunity that our legislature has granted to these parties' defendant to ensure the safe, fair, and efficient administration of jail. And I think, again, to me, the critical question is sovereign versus statutory immunity. Does the court have any further questions on that point?
Oh, I have one related question.
Mr. Zitter?
What about the immunity to the extent that the activities they were engaged in on this particular occasion are ministerial in nature?
This court has made it very clear, I think just last May, in the Weber case, Clay versus Weber, that the ministerial discretionary function, the ministerial discretionary distinction applies to sovereign but not statutory immunity. That was in Clay versus Weber. And I think that's another guiding beacon for the court in this case, is its recent unanimous decision in May in the Clay case, because there again the court has recognized there's a clear distinction between sovereign and statutory immunity. So
that was a footnote, and the issue wasn't presented quite the same way it is today. Do you think Clay really went that far?
Well, I don't have the text in front of me, but yes, I quoted it.
Let me just ask it this way. I mean, how does that relate to Kelo? It doesn't seem to square up with Kelo.
All right, Justice Zitter, there again, Kelo is a sovereign immunity case. And in that case, the purported immunity not only went to the sovereign, but its individuals doing ministerial acts that involve no discretion. So, number one, it's again a sovereign case, and hence the distinction between ministerial and discretionary becomes operative. And the court, I think, in Kelo, its holding essentially was, look, you have state employees doing purely ministerial things, and it is unconstitutional to assert sovereign immunity there and deprive, injured parties of any recourse whatsoever. So I think, again, because Kelo dealt with sovereign, that's where ministerial and statutory immunity distinction was made. And so back here in Clay and in the court here case here today, again, we're talking about statutory immunity in the legislature. It's just hard for me, never having been a legislator, to imagine that we have a legislature sitting up there in 1986 saying, look, we're going to establish this people fund, and we've got the governor going for it, and we're going to waive sovereign immunity. We're going to let ourselves be sued to the extent that we've got coverage here, and it enumerated certain areas that were covered and not covered. And on the other hand, in that very same session, say, but here, we're going to have this SDCL 321 with notice provisions and specific waivers in statutory cases to say, all right, I guess I fail to see how, why 321 would have been at all necessary if it was in the intent of the legislature that the immunity that it was creating with that statute is being taken away to the extent there's coverage of the other statute. And that's why I think it is so important. The people fund and the risk pool, the amnesty filers in this case, are risk pools that provide indemnity in certain circumstances for state or lower level government entities. Sovereign immunity, the People Fund says, we're going to ensure where there's coverage here that we are waiving liability, but for these other entities, we're specifically creating a liability. And again, I fail to see how the legislature, acting in any rational form, could say, all right, we, the state, we're immune from suit, and we're not going to keep it that way. We're going to have the People Fund, and we're going to take off this cloak of immunity in the sovereign sense, but go and say, by the way, you jailers, we're going to grant you immunity here in 1986, but with this statute, we're really taking it away too because you got coverage. It would be totally inconsistent. So I think that the intent of the legislature is clear, and I think that this court has been clear in recognizing the dichotomy between sovereign and statutory immunity. This case involves statutory immunity and significant public policy. And I think our position ought to be vindicated. That is that the waiver, quoted by Justice Konecamp, applies to sovereign and not statutory immunity.
One last thing. Isn't the distinction between statutory and sovereign immunity somewhat artificial from the standpoint that the legislature couldn't pass a statute unless they had sovereign immunity. There, and Article 3, Section 27 specifically says that the legislature shall direct the manner in which sovereign immunity shall be asserted. So the legislature, when it enacts a statute, is really just exercising its sovereign immunity, is it not?
I think not, Justice Hunter, for this reason, that you have certain non-governmental immunities that have been granted, reporting child abuse, physician peer review, communities, recreational land use, which can apply to a private actor, the defibrillated case. So there are immunities granted by statute which don't go to government or government employees. So they are statutory, and they have nothing to do really with sovereign immunity because the sovereign's not involved. So, again, I think the legislature is fully aware of its position, and it's inconceivable to me that it would act with, to give with one hand and take away with the other in the same session. So I respectfully ask the court to rule in favor of the appellants, I guess we are today. Thank the court for its time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Timpson. Ms. Whitler, do you have 20 minutes?
May it please the court, counsel? I want to start right where Justice Zinter just asked Mr. Timpson the question about whether this distinction between sovereign immunity and statutory immunity is artificial, because it is. It is just an artificial, it's a very clever argument being made by the defendants that there's this distinction between sovereign immunity and statutory immunity, but it's a distinction without a difference.
So the legislature's been basically wasting its time for the last 20 years passing all these statutory immunity bills that mean nothing because the people protection is out there?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The statutes that are being addressed here, let me start where we're at here today. This case involves a public entity. It does not involve private individuals. These are public entities. So today we're talking about public entities. Our position is there's no such thing as statutory immunity as it relates to public entities. Now, I am fully agreeable to the legislature passing statutes that allow people like me to run a defibrillator without potentially being sued for it, or people to report child abuse, or physicians to do those types of things. Those are private individuals. Why I'm saying it's an artificial distinction is if you look at what is sovereign immunity is the global, the king can do no wrong. In South Dakota, the legislature, and actually any public entity in South Dakota, has absolutely no liability for anything it does. That's where we start when we talk about public entity liability. The rule is they have none. That's been the rule since for centuries in England. It was the rule when the United States Constitution was adopted. It was the rule when the South Dakota Constitution was adopted. The king can do no wrong. Public entities have no liability. So to carve out and say that now they've got this blanket prohibition saying they have no liability and saying, well, but yet they're still going to pass statutes that say they don't have any liability, it makes no sense. It's an artificial distinction. There is sovereign immunity. We've always looked at sovereign immunity in South Dakota as basically having two components. The first component relates to governmental entity liability. The public entity is absolutely immune. The second component is what I think has been called official immunity, which is the immunity that applies to state employees or government employees. Those folks have absolute immunity for discretionary functions that they're performing. That's been the law since 1896, State versus Ruth, but they do have liability for ministerial functions. That was the law in England. The king had no liability in England, but his ministers did. It was the law in 1824. The United States Supreme Court recognized it for the federal government. And in 1896, you recognized it for state employees, in that case involving the Commissioner of School and Public Lands. So my point is, as far as this artificial designation is, the state has immunity. It has no reason to be passing additional statutes giving it immunity. There's no reason for it. Public entities have immunity already. And what the legislature did in 1986 was pass a statute that said if public entities purchase insurance and they have insurance coverage, as is admittedly the case here, they don't have any immunity. Now, this court has looked at this issue before in Brown versus Eagan Consolidated School Districts. Pretty much an identical issue. It involved different statutes, but it's the same issue. In that case, a woman was injured in an accident with a school bus. School district had insurance, but it claimed that there was a separate statute that made it have no liability for the operation of its buses. The trial court in that case said, wait a minute, I'm going to read those two statutes together, and I'll agree that you've got no immunity for operating your buses except to the extent you've purchased insurance coverage. That's the way we have to harmonize those statutes. When it came up to this court on appeal, the court actually found that the statute didn't give the school district the immunity it thought it did. But you went on to address the argument, same argument being made here today by Davidson County and Hutchinson County, concerning this statutory immunity question. And what you found in Eagan is that when a statute merely reiterates the common law doctrine of sovereign immunity, it's waived by the purchase of insurance coverage. When you look at the statutes here in this case, I call them the jail statutes, with respect to how they apply to these public entities, they do nothing more than reiterate the common law doctrine of sovereign immunity. That is what we have in this situation. And it is our position that by purchasing liability insurance that clearly covers these acts, Davidson County and Hutchinson County waived their right to claim immunity under whether it's through a statute or through the common law. Once, as this court found in the Cromwell case, once a public entity has purchased insurance that covers the action, and that action, that cause of action accrues, there is insurance coverage. There is no immunity for the action.
Well, if there is no distinction, then why did the legislature in 1986, in the same bill, pass the jail statutes and the general waiver statute?
I think it was actually in two different bills.
Well, it was in the same session.
Yes, that's correct.
And my recollection was it was the same bill, but it doesn't matter. I mean, during the same session, then they would pass these the same bill. Why? There's got to be a reason.
That's a good question. I think that primarily the reason, as I read the statutes, is perhaps they were trying to establish a discretionary ministerial distinction. The defendant, Hutchinson County, argues that they were passed to protect private individuals, actually, as well as public individuals. I don't know what was going on in 1986. I don't know if we had an issue in our state with respect to a jail operational issue at that point. They may well have been clarifying that for those political subdivisions that choose not to get coverage, they wanted to clarify what the rules were as far as those are pretty broad statutes. They don't just apply to jail operations. They apply to food service and all types of things. So my position would be that they were trying to make it clear what exactly constitutes a jail operation procedure for purposes of those political subdivisions that don't purchase the insurance for it. Because I suppose there could be an argument made that, you know, if an inmate got food poisoning while at a prison and there was no insurance coverage, is that actually a sovereign, you know, who provided the food service or those types of things? I mean, that's my reading of those statutes, Justice Zinter, because they didn't, when they passed the People Fund statutes, they didn't say, except as provided in other statutes, where we're going to give you immunity to the extent you've purchased insurance, you've waived your immunity. I mean, they didn't. It's a both way kind of thing. I think if you read the statutes the way that Hutchinson County and Davidson County are asking you to read them, you eviscerate the insurance statute. You know, so there's definitely a tension between those statutes.
Well, wouldn't Davis and Hutchinson County still need the insurance for its other governmental operations that aren't under the auspices of the jail statutory immunity statutes? I mean, counties do a lot of things.
But they don't have to buy insurance for it.
No.
If they don't buy insurance, they're absolutely immune.
Which is one thing that concerns me, quite frankly, is if we buy into your argument, is the situation worse for potential claimants because all of a sudden the legislature in its wisdom decides no more people fund. We'll just go on immunity. Nobody gets anything.
Well, this is an extremely easy solution. There's an extremely easy solution for the people fund and for any insurance company. Exclude coverage for jail operations. I mean, I can't remember which case I've read here. I think it was the Hansen versus South Dakota Department of Transportation case where this court outlined the litany of exceptions that are already in place in the people fund, you know, what it doesn't cover. It's very easy to add an exception for jail operations. Same thing with private insurance. This is not complicated for the insurance companies to do. They can simply exclude jail operations if that's what they want. In fact,
is that what they were doing here? Is that what they were doing by passing this statute?
I don't believe so. I don't think they were trying to exclude. If you try to read those two statutes together, I think that what they were doing was excluding jail operations, except to the extent that there's insurance coverage for them. I don't know how else you can read those two statutes in harmony. As the trial court said in Brown versus Egan Consolidated School Districts, and to get back to the insurance company issue, you know, this court has had this issue before it previously in 2001 in the case of Hall versus Williams. The issue was before the court. The court ended up concluding that because neither 321.8 or 9 applied in that case, it was not going to reach the issue of the insurance coverage. Well, if the insurance companies and the People Fund are that worried about this, they've had 6 years to exclude this from their coverage. They could have done that very easily. I don't see that this is going to cause a whole-scale loss of insurance coverage. I mean, this is a very narrow issue.
Well, doesn't that ignore the way commercial insurance is written, standardized, and marketed throughout the United States? I mean, they'd have to guess and look to see, you know, what's immune in every single state. I mean, all the different statutes that could apply.
Well, I guess they know, apparently, since this was argued in 2001, and it was actually an adverse decision to the insurance companies in 2001 at the trial court level, they know this statute is in play in South Dakota. They have to write insurance that's specific for South Dakota. You know, certainly county attorneys, state's attorneys know about these things. I mean, this is something county commissioners could just say, you know, we don't want insurance coverage for our jails. I don't think this is that complicated of an issue. It's an easy exclusion to write if that's what they want to do.
If we follow your argument, though, does that open the possibility to lawsuits in other areas, too? For example, child abuse reporting. Are we now saying, once we open this up, that people who report child abuse now can be subject to lawsuits?
I don't believe so. There's no statute that says to the extent people have insurance, they've waived any liability or, you know, they've consented to be sued like there is for public entities. If I'm protected, if I report, this, it's an entirely different issue between private individuals and public entities.
What about social workers then? Social workers who undertake certain responsibilities. They work for the state. Are we opening up lawsuits to them when they make decisions in child abuse cases?
They already are open to lawsuits under National Bank versus Lear. If a social worker is performing a ministerial act, they are subject to potential liability. But I will say there's a statute, and I know the defendants have cited this as an immunity statute. There's a social worker, what I call the social worker good faith statute. Don't have it right off the top of my head. It was discussed in the Parrish case, I know. Social workers, after the Lear decision, the legislature passed a bill that said a social worker who's performing ministerial acts, certain ministerial acts, is not liable unless you show they did not act in good faith. That's not an immunity statute. That's simply the legislature saying, we're going to go ahead and put a different standard of proof on what you have to prove for social worker liability cases. Similarly, the legislature could put a different standard of proof in for what you have to prove in jail operation cases where there's been a waiver of immunity by the purchase of insurance. But that is not an immunity statute for social workers. It's simply a change in what the standard of proof is.
Did you seek punitive damages in this case?
You know, I honestly don't remember.
Well, the reason I bring it up is the point that you're just saying, well, there's no problem here for these public officials. They've got people coverage, but they wouldn't have for a claim of punitive damages, which puts their neck on the line.
I don't think we could have brought a claim for punitive damages, Your Honor. We only have negligence claims, and they would not support a punitive damages.
Well, I mean, we can come up with fact scenarios where you get the wanton and willful allegation, and all of a sudden you're not going to get summary judgment as a defendant on that kind of a claim. So all of a sudden now you have a state employee or a county employee facing a threat of punitive damages that they have to defend at their own personal expense because they have no people coverage.
Well, I guess the same thing could be said of state employees sued for ministerial functions in any respect. State employees are not immune from lawsuits for their ministerial functions. And getting back to the People Fund did not just cover ministerial functions. The People Fund and the waiver of immunity is a waiver of immunity for the governmental entity, not just the government employees. I mean, so that statute is very broad as far as what is waived when you purchase insurance. I also, you know, if you adopt the argument that the defendants are raising here, and find that there's immunity, this new brand of statutory immunity under 321.8 and 321.9, I do think you have to reach the issue of how does that play with Kylo, with the ministerial discretionary function ruling in Kylo. Those statutes purport to immunize not just the public entity, but all employees for the consequences of all of their actions, which is completely different than centuries of law the rule has been that public employees are simply not immune for their ministerial actions. And I don't think, in a footnote in Clay versus Weber, you meant to overturn over a century of law in South Dakota that said that public, State versus Ruth, that said that public employees are responsible for the consequences of their ministerial actions. I think that if you're going to say that the purchase of insurance didn't waive it, you then have to go to the second step and say, well, how do these statutes fit under Kylo? And I don't think you can say it's a statutory immunity as opposed to a sovereign immunity issue because it is a public entity. If it's a public entity, sovereign immunity is what we're talking about. We're not talking about anything else.
Is this a ministerial case?
Yes.
What happened here?
Yes. We have very, very clear claims. There are jail policies that are specifically written out that were absolutely not followed in this case. There's plenty of case law out there about the provision of medication to prisoners is not a discretionary function. That issue has not been fleshed out at this point, given that we're on a certified question from the federal court, but if you look at our complaint, yes, there are allegations clearly of ministerial conduct, which distinguishes this case from Webb, which is the Eighth Circuit decision that frankly brought us here today. Webb is the case that held that 321.8 and 321.9 are separate statutory immunity statutes, but Webb then went on to say that because the allegations in Webb were merely discretionary function allegations, it wasn't going to address what would happen to those statutes if they were trying to protect state employees from ministerial conduct.
You keep referring to the fact that this is a public entity case, not a person case. But yet we're being asked to interpret Sections 8 and 9, which refer to persons and public entities in the same statute. Now, we can't really say this statute was intended to mean different things, it seems to me. the inclusion of everything in the statute requires us to go one direction or the other.
I do disagree with that, Justice Sinter, because we are talking, you're being asked to compare two statutes. The one is the statute on public entities who purchase insurance, and the other statute then is as it relates to a public entity running a jail. I think that that's an incredibly important distinction, because we're talking public entity to public entity here. Whether that statute, those jail statutes, apply to private individuals or not is not an issue this court has to decide to answer this question. It's a question of public entity liability and public entity waiver of its immunity by purchasing the insurance coverage.
Say that this decedent had been placed in a state institution, state pen, rather than a county one. You get the same result?
Yes.
Okay, there's no difference because it's a county versus the state itself.
No, assuming the state had coverage.
Yes.
Assuming the state has coverage for the pen, yes, you get the same result.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Woodward. Mr. Timpson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank the court. Again, Ms. Woodward. A couple of things. Brown versus Eagan School District really doesn't have much to do with why we're here. The statutory scheme, I think Justice Kodenkamp expounded on it in that opinion, was the school district operates school buses and has insurance, no immunity. The school district could, under the other statute, allow other nonprofit entities for youth to use its school buses. The Flanders School says, hey, it's summertime, but we got a city parks program. We're going to use our school buses and let them take these kids to Sioux Falls to go to the zoo. What the statutes read together says that if there's an accident, you might be able to sue the parks program, but not the school district when they're using, they're loading their buses for an approved purpose. The immunity was to the school district when somebody else was using the bus, not for its own action. So it really doesn't apply here. Statutory and the sovereign immunity distinction really ascends above a mere footnote in the Clay case. For example, I believe it's discussed in 2001 in the Brown Eyes case. That was a social worker liability where the court said, in essence, that two non-supervisory employees performing ministerial acts were not entitled to sovereign immunity, but they were entitled to statutory immunity. Now, let's go back to 1986. Justice Zinner, I don't know whether it was the same bill, but I think we all agreed it was the same session. The legislature stands up before the world, or at least the people of South Dakota, and says, we are immune. We can store dynamite next to daycare centers, and you can't do anything about it. We are immune. End of story. No, that's not good enough. It's not good public policy in the 20th and now the 21st century. We're going to abrogate that immunity for the kinds of activities I discussed earlier. Now, if that were the end of the story, and the jail statute meant what Ms. Woodward says they mean, that statute is totally superfluous. If we're going to say, we, the legislature, are going to say, sue us to the extent we have coverage, you don't need a social worker statute, you don't need a jail statute, because it's all included. You can sue us. If the jail doesn't have coverage, immunity's not waived, but if they do, why mention it? Now, I think, as the Chief Justice said, are we to assume that the legislature engaged in a wholly superfluous, empty act that has entertained for lo these 21 years? They said specifically, in this and other cases, that yes, generically, the global, we as a state are waiving immunity to the extent there's coverage. However, it is not a blanket waiver because we are niching out certain other activities where statutorily we're going to maintain that immunity. And 3-21 and 8 and 9 are two of those statutes. To read them any other way makes them totally inconsistent. If they had intended that jailers waived immunity to the extent they had coverage, there's no reason to have enacted 321-89 to begin with, because the general people fund statute takes care of it. Coverage, no immunity, end of story. Why insert and add that in there? The legislature has to be presumed to know what it was doing. And I think it's a well-stated policy of this court that the legislative intent should be effected and statutes should be construed harmoniously and toward their intended purpose whenever possible. This is not a highly strained case. And there is, of course, I think the Chief Justice touched on it, the public policy question. You know, counties have, or inmates have, a rights-protecting scheme, if you will, in Section 1983 and related statutes. A contrary decision forces a county to say, fine, you know, let them starve on bread and water. We'll just cancel our insurance. And you can't do anything, and there's no source of recovery. I think that would be highly contrary to the public policy of the state. For example, I think when you're going to insure a jail, you're going to insure a sheriff's department apart from those exceptions carved out by 8 and 9, as I'll call them.
They never did reference that, and normally they do. If they carve out exceptions, they'll say except for, you know, waive immunity except for.
I think they did it in the separate statutes. I think that's what 321, 8, and 9 do.
I understand that, but they didn't reference it specifically.
No, they didn't.
And
they
very
didn't.
Often they do when they want to accept something out.
Yeah, I mean, in some cases, and I think most of the other ones, they don't reference the 2132A, what I'll call people fund broad waiver. But, so you have Davidson County, and I may go in there to take a deposition. A person may go in there to visit a family member, a physician or nurse might go in there for health care reasons, a pastor to minister, and slip and fall and hurt themselves in the parking lot. Or maybe they're assaulted by another inmate. Are we going to abrogate all that insurance? You know, there are lots of reasons other than prisoner things. We have, as Chief Justice Gilbertson pointed out, there's patrol vehicles moving about. There's a lot of non-prisoner-related things for which a county can have liability. And its immunity from that liability is waived to the extent that it has either risk pool or people fund protection, but not for inmate care, escaping inmates, and those enumerations, you know, set forth specifically in 321, 8, and 9. So I guess, again, I think it would the court is going to have to entertain the idea that the legislature said, look, we're waiving immunity, and we're waiving it for jailers, too, to the extent they have insurance, but we're still going to enact another statute that says they're separately immune. But they mean the same thing. And that's essentially the plaintiff's position here. And it's clearly not. They're saying sovereign, as a sovereign, we're funding this and we're waiving that immunity, but as a matter of statute, we're going to have social workers, jail keepers, and others that are going to be immune from civil liability under our statute. I don't think they're inconsistent. I think the legislative intent is clear from the time frame in which these things were enacted. I think this court has understood that from Brown Eyes to Clay in its decisions, and I think that it ought to rule accordingly in the case before today.
If we adopt your position, because this is a ministerial case, how are you going to square that with Kelo?
Yeah, I'm sorry,
this is a ministerial act case. Ms. Woodward says that they violated some written policies. So we have a ministerial act case. How are we going to square the constitutionality of these statutes with Kelo?
Well, first, I'm going to answer that question to parts if I can. I disagree that it's a ministerial case. There may be written policies, but there's a high level of discretion and judgment involved in when you take blood pressure, and when you start calling in an outside ambulance, when you consult a physician, when you isolate somebody and put them under 15-minute watch as opposed to the hourly checks or the video cameras. So I think it's a highly discretionary case. I disagree with her characterization in that instance. Second, in Webb and again in this court's own cases, Clay and others have held that where you have a statutory case, the ministerial discretionary distinction is not applicable. But having said that, the Kelo case, I think, is distinguishable because that granted an absolute blanket immunity to lower-level employees for purely ministerial acts. And that's what this court said in the sovereign immunity context is unconstitutional because in sovereign, the discretionary ministerial distinction is operative. it's probably the actionable thing, if you will. And so they said, hey, ministerial acts have never been excused or covered by sovereign immunity. And according to our Constitution, to the extent that it's adopted the common law theory of sovereign immunity, you can't take away what wasn't there to begin with, i.e., you know, protection for purely ministerial acts. So I don't think, Justice Zinner, that conflicts with the Kelo case at all. I'll just close by saying again, you have to assume, if you rule otherwise, a total superfluous act by the part of the legislature and say, we're waiting immunity for insurance, jailers are immune, but they got insurance, they're really not immune. I think it's just contrary to the manifest intention of the legislature and a clear meaning to those not inconsistent statutes. Again, thank you for its attention this morning.
Thank you, counsel. We will be in recess for 10 minutes.